Welcome to the Institutional History Society's festive podcast, Christmas Conviction. Your hosts for the day are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter. Crime and the 25th of December have gone hand in hand since before it even had anything to do with the birth of a saviour. The Roman feast of Saturnalia, an ancient forerunner to Christmas, harboured just as many foul deeds. Indeed, a plot to put the entire city to the sword one Saturnalia was uncovered by the great orator Cicero himself. In later years, Christmas was a strange time. Under the Puritans, the very celebration was a crime. Today, we're going to share with you some festive traditions, followed by the workings of institutions at Yuletide, and a selection of the crimes and intrigues that took place during the midst of the merriment and revelry. The workhouse. If you spent 30 years in a workhouse from between 1828 to 58, your head would have been spinning trying to keep up with the changing rules on how to keep Christmas. At the start of this period, there was a history of sharing food with the unfortunate. In St. Martin in the Fields, the inmates were even given roast beef and alcohol, which isn't all that different from a modern Christmas, certainly not from mine. By 1834, with the implementation of the Poor Law Commission, things changed dramatically. The commission stated, "No pauper shall be allowed to have or use any wine, beer, or spirituous or fermented liquors unless directed in writing by the medical officer." They also instructed that no extra ration was to be given on any feast day. This was eventually softened to allow for gifts from members of the public, but this could not negatively impact the union's coffers. It was about this time that certain dark and disturbing workhouse Christmas songs appeared. One of them, Workhouse Boy, was a song about a child being used as the main ingredient for the Christmas soup provided to the inmates. As the era progressed, and the marriage of Queen Victoria brought Albert and his German traditions to the fore, Christmas became more than a simple religious holiday. It became a time of generosity. And this was cemented in 1843 by Charles Dickens' preeminent work, A Christmas Carol. By 1847, the new Poor Law Board decided that extra rations should be given as part of the standard procedure at Christmas. Many benefactors would dress in their finest and descend on the miserable workhouse to spread good cheer with their condescension. This continued until the end of the Victorian era. The prisons. Prison was an entirely different beast altogether. The men, and women in some instances, were here due to their own wrongdoing and not as members of the industrious poor down on their luck. They were there to be punished, and as such, the only extra provision at Christmas for many was that of a second religious service. Religion being one of the cornerstones of the planned rehabilitation of all miscreants. The idea was to feed the soul, if not the body. This religious service, rather than bringing hope to inmates, left them bereft and despairing. Dr. McCook Weir, author of Prison Despotism, found Christmas service to be so harrowing in his silent cell that he was struck by the urge to end his life. Fortunately, he survived to tell his tale. For some inmates, Christmas made no difference. As a religious holiday to the often secular labouring poor, it meant little. As a time of excess for those with nothing, it was worse than a smack in the face. When a chaplain reviewed 25 of his inmates at a local prison, he found that not a single one knew the month in which Christmas fell. With that level of sad ignorance, what could a religious holiday mean to them, aside from possibly a day of less labour and hopefully more food? Speaking of food, whilst those at Newgate could purchase their fare from local inns and thus experience the meagre imitation of Christmas joy, for most, the standard fare of the prison system was nowhere near as exciting. Those on a number one diet, bread and pints of gruel, would stay on a number one diet. Those punished would stay punished. The only difference in the daily routine was a reprieve from the standard hard labour. Only those carrying out necessary duties, cooking, laundry, and the prisoner nursemaids, would be expected to fulfil them. The soul-destroying treadmills were quietened for one day a year, and the oakum left unpicked. In the eyes of the general public, that was more than enough. But the philanthropy of the Victorian age was constant, and some people felt that every person, no matter how destitute or low, deserved some form of Christmas cheer. The wife of Governor Avery in the late Victorian era was so concerned by the plight of the inmates during the Yule season that she concocted a plan. After a day of baking, she dressed her 10-year-old son in a large coat with dozens of pockets, each stuffed to the seams with cake, and the pair descended on one of the working gangs. With a most becoming air of condescension, Mrs. Avery distracted the guard with flattering conversation, allowing the nimble boy time to deposit small parcels of sweet Christmas cake all around their workspaces, whilst eagerly watched by the inmates. Occasionally, the gifts from the guards were infinitely less pleasant. In 1876, in Portland, the tradition of prisoners ending their Christmas nights in song was well established. However, this year the tunes were less than holy, and according to other prisoners, the prison reverberated with obscene and disgusting language. Many men spent their Boxing Day enjoying the punishment diet of bread and water. Upping the ante somewhat the following year, Block F North, the Catholic block, supposedly sang epithets that were beyond all description horrible and hellish. The governor was called away from his family Christmas to witness their vile vocalisations. A bread and water diet would certainly not do for these miscreants. And so the punishment doled out was infinitely higher. 24 strokes of the cat of nine tails. This took place only 10 years after the invention of antiseptic, and many years before it was in common circulation. So the damage, any damage to the skin, was a potential death sentence. This most certainly was not our idea of going on the lash at Christmas.
The Ghost of Christmas Thieve. With mistletoe beautifying every branch, all adorning each wistful eye, and the season of goodwill and cheer thick in the air, what better time is there to go a-courting? But the date our prospective beau had was not with a beautiful ruddy-cheeked girl, but with the law. On the 25th of December, 1873, our wayward darling Peter Brown was convicted of a most peculiar crime and sentenced to 5 years penal servitude at Woking Prison. Living in Long Wind, Glasgow, and working for Messrs. Hunter, Barr & Co., headwear manufacturers extraordinaire, life was pretty good for Peter Brown, William Heenan, and their accomplice John Lawrence Crossley. That is, until they committed a most captivating crime. Between August and October 1873, our troublesome threesome pulled off a most extraordinary hat-trick. That is, the theft of over 1,290 felt hats from their employers. Not content with being a lowly grunt, Peter had sought a way to make more money, owing his employer no fealty, not even a felty hat. The crime was eventually discovered, and the thieves were swiftly found and captured, all except Heenan, who managed to get away, and was declared an outlaw in the process. The two remaining fez filchers were taken to court and, despite stolen goods being found in their possession, pleaded not guilty. The court disagreed and, with cool heads, despite unsnatched hats, sentenced John Crossley to 7 years in prison and our Peter to 5 years. Peter ended up in Woking Prison, served his time, and was released 5 years later on licence. The story has a happy ending, at least, as Peter from thenceforth was a free man, and, to cap it all off, never stole another hat again in his life. Lout and about. 'Tis the season to be jolly. Jolly well drunk. There's something about Christmas which really brings out the rambunctiousness in even the staidest of adults. Call it Christmas cheer, or being in high spirits. It is the perfect time to let loose, overindulge, and express to excess. Even so, some immoderates take this to the nth degree. Woking, twinned with Benidorm, witnessed an epidemic of disorderly behaviour over the festive period. Between Christmas Eve and Day, the town saw a spate of 6 acts of public indecency, which, rightly or wrongly, outraged the local people and magistrates. Such behaviour might not be considered particularly unruly now, but for 19th century Woking, it was most unseemly. On the 14th of January 1899, the Guildford County Justices passed sentences on the above. The first case concerns that of Henry Matthews, a penitent hawker who was fined 5 shillings for creating a disturbance and using obscene language on Commercial Way. The man affirmed the court's version of events. "What the constable says is perfectly right, and I am perfectly guilty," and even thanked them for letting him off at such a price. Good guy Matthews. The next case was less clear-cut, and more half-cut. At 9:15 p.m. on Christmas Day, Thomas Sexton, Benjamin Ingram, John Ingram, and James Muslin, designated as lads in the newspaper article, were caught using obscene language and shouting at the top of their voices, despite previous warnings. One of the lads was also drunk. The men denied the charge, but in sentencing the men to various fines, from 5 shillings to 10, the chairman stated, "It was abominable that the public should be subjected to such ruffianism in the streets." In another case, bearing all the hallmarks of the inebriated itinerant, Arthur Sexton and another group of lads were found to be drunk, shouting and swearing at ungodly hours in Woking. The officer who first witnessed it tried to send them home, but Arthur demurred, and in the end he had to forcibly take him home. Arthur was known to be from a bad lot, and was given the choice of either a fine of £1 or 14 days imprisonment. He went to prison, where he'd now have his choice of bars. Charles Davis and James Woodall were also fined £1 and 5 shillings respectively, also for disorderly conduct. If we've noticed a pervasive theme here, it is that drunkenness and groups of men do not mix very well. However, the fairer sex too can be prone to bouts of bawdiness also. Goodall year round, except for Christmas. Charlotte Goodall was a woman who enjoyed a drink and a dance. A bit too much. At 8:20 p.m. on Christmas Day, Goodall and a man called Higley were visibly drunk and carousing on Church Street. Their behaviour was raucous, inappropriate, and inebriated, and was deeply offensive to sensible Victorian society. Moreover, only 2 hours earlier, she was seen in the street banging a tray and screaming her head off. Clearly, she'd had a little too much Christmas spirit. For these 2 acts she was hauled before the court, having missed her first requested appearance, and flat out denied banging a tray, or even leaving the house on Christmas Day, despite being seen by 2 police officers. Charlotte stood with solemn appearance as the charges were read out, exclaiming, "Let me lay myself upon your mercy. I am truly sorry. What shall I do?" before bursting into tears. For her night of excess, she was sentenced to 1 month's hard labour, and was taken from the court weeping. The Fall of Giants. Christmas 1899 was an important date. Aside from being 8 days shy of the fin de siècle, and a century unlike anything experienced before, it heralded in the birth of Humphrey Bogart, famed actor, the Emperor of Ethiopia granting mining rights to the Swiss engineer Alfred Ilg, and, much nearer to home, Old Woking bore witness to the cremation of a late great politician. Hugh Grosvenor, 1st Duke of Westminster, was aristocracy to the core. Son of a wealthy marquis and keen on gentrified pursuits such as hunting and racing, he was a true blue blood through and through. Like all wealthy men of the era, he was educated at Eton and reached Cambridge. He left before completing his degree, however, to pursue a career in politics. Hugh served for a time as MP of Chester, but upon the death of his father in 1869, Hugh was thrust from a largely private life into that of the supremely political. He was given his father's title and entered the House of Lords. Whilst fated never to reach the dizzying heights of supreme office, he nonetheless proved to be a thorn in the side of Gladstone, opposing his reform bill and proving instrumental in his first resignation. Undeterred, Gladstone remained his friend and proved instrumental in his elevation to the dukedom. But Hugh's real passion was that of a temperate, stable man. He raised horseflesh in the country, winning a number of derbies, was a keen philanthropist, chairman of the Queen's Jubilee Fund, which provided nurses for the sick poor, and was a member of the Council of Cremation, whose aim, as the name would suggest, endorsed immolation over burial. In addition, he was teetotal, and on his estate alone commissioned 4 churches and chapels, 8 large houses, about 15 schools and institutions, 50 farms in whole or part, 300 cottages, lodges, smithies and the like, 2 cheese factories, 2 inns, and about 12 commercial buildings. His legacy, aside from the tangible buildings and endowments to various charities, was that of a moderate man who, whilst purported to be the wealthiest person in England, abhorred snobbery, and even seeing his own name in print. Hugh breathed his last at his granddaughter's house in Cranbourne, Dorset, and died at the age of 74 from bronchitis. Hugh's body was removed from the house and taken to Brookwood to be cremated on Christmas Day. Poached eggheads. Christmas dinner for us is the crowning moment of this great festive day, particularly if you buy a turkey. Surrounded by tottering trays of roast potatoes, beds of pigs in blankets, steaming vegetables and vats of gravy, this noble bird sits proud above its gastronomic kingdom. But there was a time when poultry was the preserve of all but the wealthy, and the poor would have to make do with what they could rustle up, typically rabbit. For those unwilling or wanting to save a penny or two, meat could be found elsewhere in abundance, if you are willing to break the law. Early Christmas morning 1877, Alfred Head, a deserter from the British Army, and his son had one such idea. They would sneak into Sutton Park near Woking and bag themselves a free meal. Armed with guns, they snuck into the estate at 3 a.m. and began to shoot game. The gamekeeper, George Taylor, and his son William, heard the retort of a gun and headed over to the copse to see what was happening. The Heads, seeing the Taylors, levelled their guns at them and told them to stand, but out of duty they refused to do so, closing in on the poaching duo. Alfred Head, known to be a man of violence, took umbrage and set about the elder Taylor with his gun stock. He beat him about the body and face till the man was insensible and the base of his gun had broken off. His son too had broken his gun stock upon the prone form of George Taylor. With no hope of apprehending them, William Taylor called for quarter and the two poachers escaped. George Taylor survived, just, but it was noted at trial that the beating had placed his life in mortal danger. For their crimes, Alfred and his son were sentenced to 5 years penal servitude and 6 months hard labour respectively, all because of a free meal. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History Society's festive podcast, Christmas Conviction. We couldn't have got this far without the London Archives, the British Library, and the Woking Lightbox.